Little does Dr. Maurer know, when I ask him for matching money, the match is already in hand. My brother is a neurologist, and he's, according to my mother, the real doctor in the family. That's why we'd have a longer introduction for her. It's always a pleasure and an honor, really, great honor, to be here with Dr. Maurer and at NFB with the DRBA members. I really have a blessed time of my career as a PhD and a JD. I get to act as counsel, co-counsel, pro bono with the likes of Larry Paradis sometimes and Linda Dardadian and others in the room, but also act as an expert witness sometimes based on my empirical work. And last summer was kind of unusual. I was an expert in a case in New York City in federal court testifying in trial, which was unusual, before Jesse Furman, a relatively new judge. By the way, it was his first trial and his parents were there to see how he would do. True story. His brother is the economic advisor for the Obamas. I forget his first name, Furman. And that was with disability rights advocates, and we won a very important case. But I went from that to Hampton Roads, Virginia, when I got a call from this attorney I had never heard of before, Jonathan Martinez, sitting over here, who asked me to testify in Jenny Hatch. You heard about Jenny Hatch yesterday. And I have to say, you know, both were amazing examples, but going into that little state courthouse with a really senior federal judge who'd been around the state court judge, sorry, Judge Pugh, who'd been around the block many times, was really a fascinating experience also. Everybody heard the story of Jenny yesterday and Jonathan's fantastic remarks, and we'll hear more about that today with Maureen as well. I'm going to try to act as facilitator, but I think Jonathan can convey this. So Jonathan put on several witnesses. The witness before me was a clinical psychologist who basically talked about Jenny's from a clinical point of view, and he got reamed by the state court judge. That was who I was following. This judge wanted nothing to do with this concept of supported decision making. And there were a lot of things, of course, that made this case happen. The stars aligned. I had been the first ADA case I was ever an expert witness in, I don't do this all that much, was in a case against Chuck E. Cheese. Some of you may remember the Chuck E. Cheese case. Don Perkel, the largest, one of the largest verdicts ever in an ADA case. Of course, it was cut down, $13 million in punitive damages. It reminded me of that, this kind of so clear focus on what was going on. I was to talk about self-determination, my research and writings in the area, longitudinal studies of individuals with developmental disabilities, intellectual disabilities, Olmsted, did all that. But ended up, and Jonathan can check me on this, nobody's indispensable, but ended up having what I thought was basically an amazing conversation on the bench with this judge, kind of like we're talking now, and relating back and forth to him things like, which most judges hadn't heard about, the change from the medical model to the social model, the concept behind Olmsted, the concept behind decision making, as Jonathan has talked about. And it was really a privilege I wasn't deposed ahead of time. I don't think I was. I wasn't deposed. You know, normally, like the DRA case, the EPREP case, that was a case of documents that could fill this room of New York City planning, which was a great case. But this was so personal, so interesting discussion with this judge. And maybe Jonathan can reflect if I have conveyed that correctly or not. We ended up having an incredible outcome in the Jenny Hatch case. And it was one of those cases where you know that you're glad you were involved with that. You know, one of those cases that you're going to tell your grandchildren, like I still talk about Chuck E. Cheese. not that I don't talk about the DRA cases that I've done, but one of those cases that you know is going to be a game changer. So Jenny Hatch was evolving for me in a broader context, and what I hope to do today is convey some general thoughts. Maureen and Jonathan, I'll introduce them briefly, let them talk and kind of facilitate a discussion today, because you don't need any more talking heads. Throw out some of my observations based on what I've been doing. Obviously, Jenny Hatch is occurring in a context of Olmstead. We've talked about, I don't know if Sam Bagenstos is here, he, you know, was very involved with that. Second generation Olmstead. Okay, so now everybody's in the community. Now what are we going to do? That sort of thing. It's involving, of course, in a context of the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, particularly Article 12 on capacity. I'm going over to Ireland once again to speak with the EU folks, because they are extraordinarily interested in Jenny Hatch, in concepts of capacity. In some ways, they're ahead of us in the United States on these issues. And we're really talking under the CRPD about personhood. As was said yesterday, the CRPD Article 12 talks about the right of persons before the law, the concept of legal capacity, the concept of personhood, basically active citizenship. And my talk in Ireland is going to be about concepts of active citizenship. As Dr. Maurer mentioned, No Rest for the Wicked, my book that's coming out this summer from Cambridge University Press is called Equality, with a subtitle, The Struggle for Web Accessibility by Persons with Cognitive Disabilities, which is the next frontier on which people with cognitive disabilities will stand on the shoulders of this organization and on pro bono with Larry Paradis and Linda and others in this amazing case, playing a very small part against CNN, who for some reason has decided they don't want to caption their website, their video clips, and who for some reason say that, well, if they had a caption their website, we wouldn't be limiting the free speech rights of our clients, the Greater Los Angeles Association for the Deaf, we'd be limiting the speech rights of CNN, because they'd have to caption the website, as perverse as that sounds. So we're in a new age of hyper, real-time, digital connected society, which, as we know, is a whole separate talk, brings with it great opportunities for inclusion and great opportunities for personal invasion as well, and that's what that book is about. We're also in a time where the Jennies of the world, Don Perkle is now in his 60s, the Jennies of the world are coming of age under the ADA and the CRPD. Most of my law students now were born after the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed, which is hard to believe. By 2040, the number of people, as Maureen will talk about, the number of people in the United States over age 65 will double. We have a whole group of individuals, if you read the New York Times daily about the horrific conditions facing our veterans with disabilities returning from Iraq and Afghanistan with the signature injury of cognitive disability, traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress disorder. And all these forces, interestingly, came together in that little courtroom in Hampton Roads, which informed my conversation for an hour or so on the stand. I don't think there was any cross-examination, was there? Maybe one question. Yeah, the judge. Well, the judge kept asking questions, which was fascinating. And just by way of litigation tip, Jonathan can tell you this. It was going so well that I tried to be argumentative with my own lawyer and not agree with him, to not in a false way, but to show, you know, I wasn't just up there, you know, sipping the Kool-Aid. I was trying to convey in an intelligent way issues that we were talking about. Sometimes he pushed me too hard, but he was one of the best lawyers, I say this not lightly, one of the best lawyers that I've ever worked with. And that case would not have happened but for the commitment of lawyers like Jonathan and all the other cases that I've worked on. I always say also, and this is a digression, that the expert, me, is only as good as the quality of the lawyers that we get to work with, and the people in this room who I've worked with are extraordinary. So Today, I want to facilitate a discussion and give you a few observations about what I've learned from the Jenny Hatch case, what I think is important. Jonathan was introduced yesterday. 20 years he's been litigating ADA cases, seminal cases. Since the Jenny Hatch case, we've been fortunate at the Burton Blatt Institute to partner in a small way with Quality Trust to establish the Jenny Hatch Justice Project, which is an information dissemination, which is webinars we have, and other sort of information about this issue of supported decision making. And I urge you to take a look at it. It's really developing nicely. We had our first symposium last year. We're going to have another symposium this year. And Bob Dinnerstein, I don't think he's here today, but he is another great partner of ours on this endeavor. Maureen Henry, who's getting her dissertation, who's been an aging and policy fellow in Mark Warner's office, I think, on decision making, and who has been a director of Utah's aging commission, provides a very interesting perspective from the aging community, very similar to many of the issues we're talking about in supported decision making. So I thought, in the good professorial way, I would identify a couple of exam questions for these guys to take about 15 minutes each to talk about. There's no way you can do this exam in 15 minutes. So if you're good law students, you'll write about whatever the hell you want to write about anyway, and you'll pass, at least at the better law schools, as long as it's coherent. And then we'll have a discussion. Okay, so point number one, my learning, this is the next book. The thoughts on kind of what we've learned. Number one, generic system of personhood. So obviously, and I'm glad Maureen is here, we need to begin to talk about issues of supported decision making outside of the framework of guardianship. And Jonathan has made this point already, and that is, it's too late by the time you get into court in Hampton Roads to start educating a judge about supported decision making. We were lucky. The stars aligned. We had amazing counsel. We had an amazing client. We had a judge who was extraordinarily hostile to begin with, who was very Solomonic at the end. In some ways, he split the baby within his context, but he really opened the door to allow us to do what we wanted to do. He didn't have to go that way at all. The parents were right there, looking him in the eyes, telling him what he wanted. And this was a judge who was an older judge who was not out of the social rights ADA model as we know it. So that's one point I'd like you to think about. The second is, as Jonathan said yesterday, clearly we need to make this a cross-disciplinary effort. So the docs, the gerontologists, the social workers, the counselors, everybody needs to be involved with this discussion from multiple perspectives. Number three, and this was a point I made in my testimony, which I emphasize now because I'm starting to conceptualize this, Jenny Hatch, and more generically this area, is not about at all parents versus kids. It's not about one group of individuals versus another. It's about support. It's not about against the guardian ad litem. In this case, the guardian ad litem was, I think it's fair to say, was not particularly informed on these issues.
You could say that. You could also say a lot stronger things.
You could say a lot stronger
That's
things.
That's why you're an expert.
So. I don't know if we're being videotaped or not, but there's a record of this. The guardian ad litem was amazingly adverse to our position, and that was very challenging to overcome. So point number three, this is about supported decision-making, which means, as Jonathan used the example yesterday, a mechanic with a muffler or something, it's obviously about a collaborative effort. Number four point to consider, obviously we're talking about issues of legal force. We're talking about laws and policies and procedures. You mentioned that the Virginia legislature is considering some study in this area. We need the law schools and the law professor types to develop model laws model supported decision making agreements. So there are illustrations within the context of a legal framework that people can act. Number five to consider, and not in any particular order again, handwritten last night over drinks with Chris and others. This is a life course endeavor. We're talking about personhood. So it has to start early. It has to be continued with in terms of youth in transition. And it, of course, as Maureen will talk about, it's very relevant at the later stages of life as well. This is not you turn 21, you're out of the educational system, and let's start talking about self-advocacy and self-determination. That can happen. It has to happen in third grade or fifth grade or sixth grade. And that's where the real changes will happen. It has to happen for the vets coming back with traumatic brain injury, the 300,000 vets with post-traumatic stress disorder, with TBI, with other sorts of things, who are coming back, who are young kids, basically, who are coming back to a society which will be terrifically challenging for them. Next area, again, not in particular order, we have to look, in terms of a research or a study agenda, at federal and state systems. This was alluded to yesterday. Why wouldn't these services be reimbursable under CMS? Why wouldn't they be part of an IEP plan? In what ways can the service and support systems, Voc Rehab, actively support this endeavor? And last, I'd like you to think about the good researcher that I am, having just submitted a grant, the first of its kind, to NIDR, the National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research. There needs to be, of course, evidence-based practice. There needs to be examples in empirical. I had Jonathan, maybe you want to talk about this. I had really no empirical information to talk about that dealt with this area, although I purported to talk about a lot of empirical information that dealt with this area without a smile on my face. I extrapolated from a lot of empirical information that I was aware of, but there was really no studies that I was aware of that looked at this. We have just submitted to the U.S. Department of Education a $2.5 million grant with the University of Kansas. Mike Waymire, some of you may know, who has done fantastic work on self-determination with the CQL, the Quality Trust, what is this, Center on Quality Leadership, with Quality Trust, and probably with another group that I'm leaving out, to study 1,000 individuals in...
It's almost two.
To study 2,000 individuals in Washington, D.C., to look at them over the life course on how they make decisions. Never has been done before. Relating it to a whole host of decisions and so forth. I should say, by the way, that another question is supported decision making versus guardianship. Is it one or the other? Eventually it may be the other, but of course it's not an all or nothing thing. In the Jenny Hatch case, the judge was talking about plenary guardianship, I believe, which is basically the whole enchilada. But of course, there's a whole range of mid-level areas that can be discussed. One last thing, which I forgot to mention, Maureen, and this is for you, which I think is important. Now that I'm starting to study this thing, I'm talking a lot with my doc friends around the country who work under a concept called shared decision-making, which is a similar but different discussion in the medical context, supposedly about medical life-ending decisions, important decisions, and so forth. Some people would say that there are great limits to that dialogue, and it's different than supported decision making. It's more of a guided medical decision that's really controlled, some people would say, by the docs. But clearly that dialogue is subsumed by the larger personhood discussion. But the larger discussion can certainly be informed by that context, which is particularly relevant for older adults, where medical decisions increasingly would be made, or by families, by proxy and others. So with that introduction, I'll turn to Jonathan first, and please correct me on cross-examination now if I have conveyed anything incorrectly. I wish we had a videotape of that trial. You saw a little bit of his closing argument yesterday, or maybe opening argument, but It was worthy of television time, the way this trial played out, and in large part, it was due to now my very good friend, Jonathan Martinez. Jonathan?
Thank you so much. And the first thing I have to do is check Peter, because he invited me to do that, so I feel the need. So please forgive the war story. But please understand, by the time that Peter had gotten on the stand, there were multiple days of testimony, none of which had gone well. This was not a friendly judge. I would go, and my co-counsel, Morgan Whitlatch, is here. We'd confab afterwards, and we'd say, did that go as badly as I think it did? Why, yes, it did. So what do we got to do? Something else. So we put our expert psychologist on, and we got our points across, and there was really little cross-examination of him, except from the judge, who reamed him. And I kept going back on redirect to make my points again, and the judge would ream him, and the judge would ask me why I had more questions, and I would say, well, judge, you've conducted a very effective cross of my witness. I feel I have to now redirect. So in that context, the next witness, the last one with a plane to catch in 2.5 hours, is Peter Blank. And with Peter, he sits on the witness stand, and I ask probing, intelligent questions like, what can you tell us about self-determination? And I back up. And 15 minutes later, after Peter has finished educating everyone in the courtroom about this incredible concept, I'd ask another probing question like, what is supported decision-making? And I would back up. And so it went for about an hour. And it was marvelous testimony, as you could expect. But Peter is right. There is no empirical evidence on supported decision-making. So we knew that going in, of course. So we were kind of making it up as we went along, because there is some research that kind of deals with it. So I'd say things like, are there studies about independence that you've done? And when you've got a witness with a 70-page CV, you can bet that he might have done one or two of them, and he had, and he would talk. Well, then it came time for cross, and practice tip for attorneys, when you're dealing with a genius, don't try to be smarter. So it didn't go well for opposing counsel, but the judge began doing his cross-examination, and he started doing the same type of very initially hard-fighting, how dare you question me, and I saw the most amazing thing. It was that Peter Blank simply shifted in his chair, and the two of them began chatting. It stopped being combative and started being this exchange of ideas, the end of which the judge thanked him. Didn't thank me, by the way. He couldn't even get my name right for many days of this trial. He thanked Peter. He said, you've given me a lot to think about. I hadn't considered any of this before now. Which, besides being an incredible blow to my ego, finally gave Morgan and me something to talk about, saying, hey, that went pretty well, didn't it? So that is the checking Peter Blank story. If an expert is only as good as his lawyer, I don't know who you hired, man, but it went really well. Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's talk about supported decision making. And as I was thinking about this presentation, and as you heard me say yesterday, supported decision making has to be something that isn't just the flavor of the month. In this field, we have a lot of concepts we put out, and it seems that every half decade or so, a new buzzword comes out, and a new theory, and a new way of doing things, and everyone who is then required to do things under that theory sighs and says, okay, train us now, what's the next thing? And I think if you deal with service and support workers, you know you've seen that. Oh, person-centered planning, how is this different from X and different from Y? Well, supported decision-making cannot be that, because supported decision-making is not just a way of doing things. It's actually the way of doing things, because we know this because we've all done that. When we talk about equality of opportunity and equality across spheres and equal access for people with disabilities, what is it that we're saying? We're saying that people with disabilities should have the same opportunities and same rights and same effort that we do. What could be more basic than giving people with disabilities the same opportunities to make the same choices that we make every day in the same way that we make them, in the same spheres that we make them? As I said yesterday, think about every decision that you make. unless you shoot just from the hip every time, you're probably doing some research or doing some thought or asking some people for their advice, especially as the decisions get more important. You're being smart when you do that. You're admitting that you don't know everything and you need a little more information, a little bit of help. That's called making an informed decision. You've asked for help appropriately. And yet when Jenny Hatcher, a person with a disability, does that, they're asking for help in making a decision is taken as proof they cannot make any decisions. So as we have and as we push and as we implement supported decision making, that is the attitude that has to change. And it struck me that the most impressive thing about supported decision making, the strongest thing about supported decision making, is also the weakest thing. And that's that we all do it. It is so easy to explain to people what supported decision making is because it's what they do every day. And that actually is the weakness. Because when you're talking to somebody who has a preconceived notion of what people with disabilities can and can't do, saying to them that you want a person with a disability to do something just the way that we all do it is to put up their mental roadblock. Well, wait a second. People with disabilities aren't like me. I've spent a lifetime knowing that they have limitations. Therefore, they cannot do the same things that we do. And automatically, it becomes back into that buzzword bin. So as we talk about implementing supported decision making across the sphere, it is important to communicate what it is and isn't very clearly. And the way we can do that is simply to make analogies to the professionals we deal with the way that they do things. Put another way, you're talking to a teacher, a special education teacher, and you're trying to explain supported decision making. What is supported decision making? Well, in general, it's a person with a disability receiving the information that they need to understand the situations that they face and the decisions that they make so that they can make the best possible decision while receiving input from people they trust who have information about the things they have to make decisions about. In other words, teacher, that's an IEP team. When an IEP team functions appropriately, the student-directed IEP is a model of supported decision-making. So when we talk about decision-making as a life course skill, it should start in school. It should start as early as possible with people who understand supported decision making from a professional standpoint. They just call it something different. So we advocate for student-led IEPs. We advocate for kids to be involved, and we advocate for transition planning, because this we know from studies. Decision making is a skill. It can be learned. It can be taught, and it is integral for independence. Therefore, it is an independent living skill. And what does the definition of transition planning and special education include? Instruction on independent living skills. So when a school pushes a parent to become a guardian, to me, that is a sin on multiple levels, because it means they're admitting they didn't do their job from the beginning. Because if they thought that kid had difficulty making decisions, where was the transition planning from age 14 or before to implement instruction and decision making? That is a realm for advocacy for us. Those of us who do special ed know that transition planning is getting greater emphasis. Although one would wonder why it didn't get greater emphasis before, it's nice that it's getting it now. Well, that is something that we should be arguing for. When I was supervising people who did special education in Virginia, I always said every transition plan should have multiple items. It should have something on school, work, voting, and independence. All of those have decision-making components to them. And when we talk to counselors, especially vocational rehabilitation counselors, whose job it is to help maximize a person's employment potential, well, what could be more important for being employed at the highest possible level than decision-making skills, critical thinking, and decision-making with support when needed? In other words, supported decision making is just proper vocational rehabilitation counseling. And if they can't be done through counseling, it can and should be done through VR services. We heard on the second panel yesterday from folks talking about reentry for people from jail and prison and how it's difficult to find services. And I wasn't able to ask the question, so I talked to some of them one-on-one. And vocational rehabilitation is the perfect vehicle. the vast majority of people coming out of the justice system have some type of disability and therefore should qualify for VR services. And vocational rehabilitation is the sleeping giant of disability services. There's so much they can do, they just don't know it. They just don't know it. And if we shake our heads when people recommend VR and say, they'll never do that, then we're giving them a break. We're letting them get away with not providing the services that they can and should provide. Take a look at some of the things VR entities can do. I can boil it down to this. Anything a person needs to gain, retain, or regain employment. I have gotten VR entities to pay rent and buy clothing because those are things one needs to have a job. And if one has the potential to be employed, one needs decision-making skills. So why shouldn't VR help people develop those skills, develop it through supported decision-making? Why shouldn't they implement supported decision-making? And that's something they ought to be able to comprehend. We don't have to call it anything other than what they already do. In Medicaid planning, HCBS just came out with new regulations talking about the need to stress independent living skills. I said again, what is more important than decision making? But more importantly, they stress person-centered planning. Now, as I've said, we have seen buzzwords come and go in this field, and person-centered planning is one of the latest flavors of the month. And just from a personal observation, what I am seeing in person-centered planning more and more and more is a group of people sitting around a person with a disability planning for that person or planning to that person. They are missing a critical component, the person. Person-centered planning should be planning with the person. It should be planning by the person. In other words, it should be supported decision-making. So when we talk with service providers, when we talk with Medicaid providers, we should be saying, this is what you're supposed to be doing already. Supported decision-making goes across the spheres. And we need to make people understand that, because otherwise it will never be understood. It will simply be a favor of the month. And I'll finish here. Remember about a decade ago, maybe 15 years ago, no one really believed in powers of attorney or advance directives. They were just things in the ether, the idea that a person might be able to say in advance what they would need at times when they might or might not be able to take care of themselves. And then all of a sudden, they began to gather steam and legislative recognition. And now, they're very well recognized. If you look at the Uniform Guardianship Act and most state guardianship acts, they require people to exhaust, or come close to exhaust, less restrictive remedies. And the only one they ever really mention are advance directives and powers of attorney. Well, imagine if that statute, or that regulation, included recognition of supported decision-making as a thing, as something that is done, not as a concept, but as a true methodology, understood and appreciated across spheres. We might get to that day when a judge actually asks in an uncontested guardianship hearing, what else have you tried? Have you tried supported decision making? Why don't you? And then come back if it doesn't work. And the way we do that is through, as we did with POAs and advanced directives, legislative recognition. And also through development of forms, supported decision-making agreements, just like we have powers of attorney agreement, so that we can actually go and to a doctor who would otherwise normally say, well, look, I really can't deal with you, supporter, if you're not the guardian. HIPAA requires me to deal only with the person or the guardian. Or a lawyer who would say, I can't work with you, supporter. The code of ethics requires me only to work with my client or my client's guardian. Even in the best of intentions, we would not get where we need to go across the sphere. But if there is policy or regulatory or legislative recognition of supported decision making and a tangible supported decision making agreement a person can present to a professional that includes a hold harmless, by the way, that says a professional who acts consistent with this agreement will be indemnified from any action taken consistent with it, then all of a sudden we have a thing. We no longer have a concept. And as I said yesterday, when that happens, we stop talking about people's rights and we start talking about their choices. And that is truly when we will have equality for people with disabilities. Thank you.
Maureen?
So I tried to get the questions out of Peter before we started today, and as a good law professor, he wouldn't give them to me. So now it's all swirling around. So I will start by talking about a generic system of personhood and how I think we've gotten to where we are in this issue of supported decision making, of guardianships. We have a paradigm in decision making, primarily in medical decision making, but also in making decisions about issues ranging from financial to where you live to the issue of voting that's come up a couple of times already. And that paradigm is a dichotomous paradigm. Somewhere along the line, we decided that you can draw a thin black line between the population, and you can put some of the population on one side and some of the population on the other side. And if you're on one side, you have full legal rights. And if you're on the other side, you have no legal rights, except as exercised through someone other than you. So I'm cycling kind of to the bottom and Jonathan's comments at the end. One of the concerns that I have about advance directives and about powers of attorney, as someone who both did a lot of them while I was in law practice, but also who wrote Utah's statute and has written a bill in Congress as well on this issue, is that in some ways that continues to support the dichotomous paradigm that there will be a point when you can't do it, and at that point it's okay to take you out of the picture and have someone step into your shoes and make those decisions on your behalf. So they help in some ways, but they don't get you all the way to this concept of personhood and keeping the person at the center of the equation. I've spent much of the last 5 years in a PhD program trying to figure out how we got where we are and what we can do to change it. And much of how we got where we are is that this whole paradigm of capacity across the board, across the spectrum of decisions, comes from legal cases. You can track a lot of the language back to law review articles in the 1940s, talking about the capacity to consent to contracts and the capacity to make a will. And if you follow the capacity literature into the 70s and 80s and 90s, when there were a lot of efforts to try to bring some sense and reason to the system, you find quotes from those 1940 law reviews about contract and capacity to make a will. The challenge is that no one seems to have gone back to the question of informed consent and why do we do informed consent and the roots in autonomy of informed consent. And instead of going back and saying, what's the value in autonomy, we say, well, let's assume that this is going to wind up in court. And so every decision is made based on standards that you would use to judge an irreconcilable conflict in court. And the problem is most interactions in life don't get to court, and most interactions in life don't need to get to court. So what one of the things I think we need to do is really pull away from this model of a legal construct of capacity that assumes that you have to have a dichotomous outcome, and instead start looking at this concept of figuring out how to make this work and keeping the person at the center of the equation. Some of the philosophers who've contributed to this dichotomous state, for example, Buchanan and Brock, who wrote the well-known work on deciding for others, they say that decisional capacity is necessarily a dichotomous state. But what you don't see is them or others going back and saying, what is the harm that we do to people when we take them out of decisions about their own lives? So there's this typical balance. We've got beneficence and avoiding harm on this side. We have autonomy on this side. And there's an assumption in philosophy and in law that those are two distinct states. And there's never a focus on the fact that eliminating a person's autonomy causes harm. So in a guardianship issue, the harm is always about, is this person safe at home? Is this person going to be exploited? Is this person able to be rational? It's not about, what is it going to do to this person when we say, you can't live where you want to live anymore? You're going to be left in a doctor's office and your family and the doctor are going to go out in the hall and decide whether or not you're going to have surgery outside of your presence. What does it do to people when we take away autonomy on the grounds that it's somehow avoiding harm? And you don't see that. You don't see it in the literature about capacity assessment. What you see is this assumption that you can divide everyone with a thin line. So one of the reasons I've come to support a decision making is that it really does reflect the reality that you don't have a line where you can put people on either side. By assuming that we can draw a line, what we do is we say that if you're one titch to the right of the line, you get to do everything, and guess what? You don't get any help because you're on this side of the line. Now, if you're on this side of the line, you're just out of the picture altogether. And that the reality is a big gray swath, whether you're talking about people with cognitive disabilities, whether you're talking about older adults with dementia, whether you're talking about people with mental health problems, you have a big gray area of people who have the ability to participate to some degree in decisions, even if there are places where they run into problems. One of the things that I hope we can do is to shift the research dollars. So in the past 30 years or so, millions of dollars have been spent by the federal government and by foundations helping us to draw that line and evaluating the instruments that draw that line. And if you read all of those articles, none of them ever get to, well, what do you do? Sometimes they'll actually say, you should try to improve the person's capacity before you conclude that they're out of the picture, but most of them don't even say that. They never say, how can we use this information in order to identify areas where people need support? And then keep the people in the picture, let them exercise the abilities that they retain, and then to those abilities, bring in assistance. So in older adults, one of the major issues is short-term memory loss with dementia. So how can you help support someone by having someone be that memory support? If in other cases, it may be connecting dots and figuring out, well, this is my goal, but how do we get from a specific decision, whether it's about medical care or about residential, how do we get to my goal? So I'm hoping that we can use the research that's been done to measure a lot of these things to point to where we need to go in the supported decision-making area. The cross-disciplinary piece is also very, very important. Having worked, I've spent a lot of the last 8 years in government, in medical settings, and in legal settings. And one of the things that I see is that judges and lawyers don't understand how the medical side works, and they don't understand the limits of the medical side. So you have judges who think that if a doctor comes in and says this person lacks capacity and needs a guardian, the judges think that there's something behind that. Then you have the doctors saying, well, we don't know what the standards are. We don't know what we're supposed to be doing. We're faced with some pretty awful situations of people who are in real trouble, and all we know is to go in and say to let's get a guardianship in place. So there's this disconnect across those disciplines, and I think the American Bar Association has done a nice job at trying to connect psychologists, judges, and lawyers and provide some guidance. I don't think it's all correct guidance, but it's in for a lot of these reasons that we've already been talking about. Jonathan, you're right about Medicaid emphasizing person-centered planning. There is increasing attention by CMS on quality measures, as well as with the guidelines for facility-based care. But again, we're trying to get people outside of facilities, but we are really bad at managing quality of services that are provided. So development of quality measures is going to be really important in that area. The other point that you made, Jonathan, is going back, cycling all the way back to the advanced directives and powers of attorney. Utah has an Advanced Directive Act that has essentially a model for shared decision making, in that when a person lacks capacity, the surrogate, and I don't like the word surrogate because it implies that they're replacing someone. So in my dissertation study, I'm using decision companion instead of surrogate. So it's a very structured decision-making process by the surrogate, with the first step being ask the person what they want. Number one, ask the person what they want. And then if you don't get what you need out of that, then think about, based on what this person has said specifically in the past, how would you apply that in this circumstance? If you don't have actual knowledge of something that they've said about this specific decision, then what would they say about similar decisions? So, and then the only do you get to best interest when, for example, in a hospital, they have a homeless person and they have no one who knows this person and the person is fully non-communicative, then you really, then supported decision making isn't an option. So we do have some models out there in Utah and a few other states that look at how to bring that together. And one of the things that I did while I was in DC working in Senator Warner's office is we've got a bill on medical decision making, but it does contain that structure as well. And boy, did we get pushback on that. So. Thank you.
So you both passed. You're going to go on to your graduate studies. Now let's get some objective reviewers from the audience. Dr. Maurer, do you want me to facilitate, or would you like to facilitate?
Go right ahead, Peter.
Okay, not that you had a choice anyway.
I know I didn't. There wasn't any point in getting up.
Yes, please identify yourself.
Good morning. My name's Tom Merle. I'm from Philadelphia, and I work at a large center for independent living. And I'm curious that many of the things that the panel has discussed this morning, there's a very big thing that's absent. And many of the things that you're discussing are things that have been around for years in the independent living movement. Fundamental things or principles like consumer control, consumer choice, and dignity of risk. Some of the things that Jonathan mentioned, the same ability to make a mistake and learn from that mistake. And it just seems that, why is there that absence or absence of acknowledging that, especially like Ed Roberts' mantra of nothing about us without us, and that whole type of flavor that should be overriding all these systems, whether it's aging, under 60, home and community-based services, reversing the institutional bias that exists, and so on. It seems absent. I'm not sure if I'm missing something.
Oh, it's a very good observation, Jonathan or Maureen? Jonathan?
If it's absent, it's because I explained it horribly. Because in my view, the supported decision-making model encompasses everything you just talked about. Not only is it nothing about us without us, It's I'm doing for me and you come along with the ride. That's the point. It's not decision-making for a person. It's decision-making by a person. The problem, in my opinion, with all of the existing paradigms was not one of theory, but one of implementation, or more properly, one of buy-in. Disability advocates have known and believed forever in this model. We have all practiced forever in this model, or at least preached it. The difference is we have not gotten the world at large, the providers and the professionals, to get in with it. So what I suggest, and actually, and I was thinking this ironically enough, I'm suggesting supporting the decision making of the professionals and providers by telling them this is what you're supposed to do in the first place. So it is truly a person-centered, person-directed methodology. To me, it is the difference between community integration and true integration into a community. The person integrates himself or herself into the community through this model.
Dr. Maurer?
Yeah, I have an observation. And I don't know whether this will stimulate discussion or not. You recommend the rehabilitation system. We've been working with the rehabilitation system a long, long time. Back in the 1950s, there was a move by the rehabilitation system to say, if you join that radical National Federation of the Blind, we're not going to provide you services. And Senator Kennedy and Congressman Baring out of Arizona put in the Right to Organize bill, which eventually failed, but the implementing regulations in the rehabilitation program later said you have a right to join whatever organization you want, or you can't be denied services based on participation in an organization. Now, in the 1960s, we also got adopted the idea that Dr. Tenbrook loved this thought. He said, you can't have a right to speech without having the right to be heard, which is to say the government has to listen to you. Now, it doesn't listen very well, but Dr. Tenbrook's argument was the free speech right and the right to assembly means that you have the absolute right to have the government pay attention. It doesn't have to do anything, but it has to pay attention. So we got into the Rehabilitation Act this idea that choice is part of it, and you and the individualized employment plan for employment, IPE, says that you get to decide what you're going to do. And you're right, Jonathan, you can get anything out of the rehab group, according to the law, that is needed for you to get employment, except one thing. There's one exception, and that is that the government cannot buy land for you. So if you ever want to know what the exception is, there is one, only one. It can buy you a Cadillac. It probably won't, but it can. But the reality of the rehabilitation system is that participation in decision-making doesn't happen much. So why I bring all this up is to say that there is not a solution to the problem ready-made, number one. And number two, the work that you have been doing to get supported decision making into the legal structure is of importance, and at least some of the direction that I think might help is that one or another of us gets busy and sues the rehabilitation department to help it know that participation in the individualized plan for employment does mean supported decision making.
Redirect, counselor.
You read my mind. I had the great pleasure of working with two young attorneys who are in the back row, although as I get older, they're all young attorneys. Julie Kegley and Kalina Eck. I had the great pleasure to watch them both cross-examine people from the VR agency. I watched Julie Kegley sit the commissioner of the Virginia Rehabilitation Entity and say to him, show me in the law or your regulations where it says you can't do that. And she won that trial. So at the end of the day, it is important to speak that truth to power. We want them to come along knowingly and voluntarily. We want to educate them. But sometimes a stick is required. And I say again, VR is the sleeping giant of community integration. They can do anything as long as they want to, know how to, or are told to. To me, those are three options.
If I could make a brief comment. So I became the director of Utah's ADRC. I know in the disability community, ADRCs don't necessarily have a lot of respect, and it's seen that it comes out of the aging side. We came late to the game. We wrote our proposal in the matter of a couple weeks, and we were told by the program office, you have to give equal weight to people with disabilities and people and older adults. So we did exactly that. So we funded as many independent living centers as we did aging organizations. Much of my dissertation work has been influenced by what I learned from the independent living centers during that process of creating and launching an ADRC in the state of Utah. So I don't think that the issue is that we're not recognizing what's happened. I think that other area, it's the cross-pollination, it's the cross-disciplinary issue, where as an aging person, I hadn't heard a lot of those messages prior to getting into the ADRC. So the aging side, and I think in that case, I feel like the aging side learned a tremendous amount from the disability side. The other thing that I found really interesting, though, is that some of the best educators in Utah on really, truly person-centered planning were people who come out of the greenhouse model of nursing homes. So the person-centered planning people, some of the trainers were nursing home people training the independent living center, and everyone just felt like their worlds were a little bit upside down, but people on both sides really learned. So I think when you start getting people, and mental health is out there too, and often doesn't cross paths, that what we really need to do is get all of the groups together and work on a concept that applies across all of the groups, recognizing that within the groups, people have different needs.
Yes, and Luann, do we have time for one more question?
Certainly, go
certainly.
For
and
it.
And by the way, of course, I should have said in my remarks,
we
this
have
has 13, to be a...
12 minutes left.
Oh, 12 minutes.
Well, I mean, plenty of time.
This needs to be across the spectrum of disciplinary as well. I was just out in Los Angeles yesterday or the day before working with the Sachs Institute, Ellen Sachs, a very prominent law professor who happens to have schizophrenia, wrote a book called The Center Cannot Hold, and she approaches these questions as a person who has schizophrenia with episodic conditions and a whole different array of associated issues. Sorry, we have another question. Please introduce yourself.
Sharon Krever-Weisbaum. So in Maryland, there is a lot of discussion that's brewing about supportive decision making and whether there should be a statutory, you know, change in our law. And what I heard you say was, I think you supported that, but then I was curious, Martin, were you saying that you thought we should or shouldn't build it into the statute? We have here a lot of those factors on what a surrogate, we still call that person a surrogate, what a surrogate or guardian should, how they should make their decisions, whether it's, you know, substituted judgment or best interest and all. We have all those many factors in our law. We don't have anything yet on this concept of supportive decision-making, although we have all the person-centered planning built into a process, theoretically. So I was just curious, you know, do you think we should be doing statutory changes?
So I think it's a mixed bag. One of the things that I find in the medical arena that is just perplexing is how often doctors think they're not allowed to talk to patients who have surrogates. So there's this view that if there's a court-appointed guardian, when I say, well, you talk to the patient, and they say, but there's a guardian. And I say, well, there's nothing that says you can't still talk to the patient. So sometimes I feel like there's a tension between so legalizing this that people start to think if the law doesn't say you can do it, there's an assumption that you can't. So that's a concern that I have about it. I do think that it helps to have some decision-making structures out there, but I also think that we want to continually reinforce the message that there is no prohibition against supported decision-making now, even though there seems to be a perception that there is. So I don't know, Jonathan, if you have...
There is no prohibition of supported decision-making, except no one knows what it is. I've gotten my greatest results from doctors by showing them law and saying, this is what you got to do, and if you don't do it, I'm going to sue you. I'm roughly that subtle. But the reason for including supported decision-making in law, I think, far outweighs the risks. And I think the risks can be dealt with through supported decision-making agreements. I've just begun work on drafting a model statute and a model supported decision-making agreement that includes language for the model agreement that says things like, you know, my support, you may speak with my supporter as well as me. And I think in the model supported decision-making methodology, the supporter is with the person, not instead of the person. So the doctor speaks to both, primarily toward the person, but also the person helps the person understand and make the decisions they need to make, and the agreement spells that out.
Well, please share those documents as soon as you have them, because there's a lot of conversations going on, perhaps for next session.
Be very happy to. Thank you.
Go to the Jenny Hatch Justice Project. Oh. Jenny Hatch Justice.
And that's where it'll be.
That's where it will be.
When it's done. So.
Yes, sir.
Larry Berger. I'm sure that you all know, and many people know, who are here know, that many people with intellectual disabilities do not like to go to meetings about themselves, especially because, for two main reasons that I've observed. One is that they often turn into meetings about negative behavior of some kind that the person has done, and second, because these meetings turn out to be, as they are now, amazingly bureaucratic. And you know, we have 45 minutes, and we have to get the form filled out and that kind of thing. So I just wanted to say that I think the idea of starting in the third grade, not when somebody is 14. And that's honored more in the breach than the observance anyhow, but really starting early is extremely important. The other comment I have is I represent, right now, fortunately, there's no legal issues because this was a gentleman who was in a developmental center and now he's out in a good supported group home, small group home. But he has had a guardian, his mother, for 12 years, and that really saved his life because at a time when he was so depressed about what was happening to him that he literally stayed in his bed all day and wouldn't come out, she was able to advocate for him. And she also has always tried to act for him, even though she was formerly his guardian, like a supporter, somebody who tried to find out from him what he wanted and to express that to other people. So there are guardians out there. You know, the legal structure ought to be changed, I agree, but under the current structure, there are sometimes guardians who are trying to do the right thing. So sometimes we need to be able to support those guardians as well.
Mr. Chairman, one other observation.
Please.
I come to this thought, this is new for me, which is to say, when there's a meeting about an individual and there are meetings about us, we get staffed all the time. I don't get staffed anymore, I don't think. But most blind people along the way get staffed. And when decisions are made about a blind person in school or in the rehabilitation system, take a friend. Take somebody with you, because the system is always the same, which is to say, the guys who do this all day long come, and there are several of them, and then you're there, and there are several of them, and one of you, and they don't say, let's vote on this, but the idea is, let's all decide together. You think one thing and we think the other thing. Don't you think you ought to go with the majority? Well, I very often don't think so. And so take a friend. Find somebody who's with you and who has your best interest in mind. This is what we've been doing forever. I never called it supported decision making before, but I'm going to adopt the terminology. It'll really help. And I'll say, you know, this is in law, you know, this is, there are legal cases about this now. But take somebody with you, and you got a much better, the chances of success for your side of the argument go dramatically up when this happens. We have an organization to provide friends, and the National Association of Deaf, I hope, does this too, and I think it does, and maybe there are some others, but one of the things we need to do is get enough people who know what's going on out there to have friends for everybody who needs to have them in these staffing meetings.
Very important observation. You know, and Jonathan, maybe you want to talk about this, unless we're running out of time. The next generation, even of these cases, Jonathan could talk about this, is getting calls from parents who don't want to be guardians of their adult children. They want them to fly free, but they are being required by state systems to be guardians so that their children can receive services from that state system. So you have these other perverse incentives, and that I don't want to give away too much, but that's the next case.
It is the next case. But to your questions, Mr. Berggren, it's very nice to meet you. We've spoken on the phone before. Perhaps this is apostasy in my field. I do not think all guardianships are bad. I don't think guardianship is evil. Guardianship is neither good nor evil. Guardianship is a tool. Use the tool the right way for the right job, things get fixed. Use it the wrong way and you can get hurt. So everyone you look at as an individual, and there are many guardians who actually practice supported decision making, whether they know it or not. We will be bringing a case in the very near future on one exactly like that, where parents were pushed into the guardianship system and don't wish to be guardians, and it is significantly harder to get out than it is to get in. So that will be, we hope, the next groundbreaking matter for the Jenny Hatch Justice Project. To your first point about people with intellectual disabilities not liking to go to meetings and the way those meetings devolve, I think you're correct. That is why what we call for is a complete change in the way things are done. Things are done to and for people with disabilities now. It becomes bureaucratic. It becomes a sign here so we can say we're done. We need to change that from a young age. That's why it needs to be supported decision making through the spheres. If the teachers buy in elementary school, it'll be so much easier for the ones in high school in transition, and later the VR counselors and later the doctors. Supported decision making is not the latest concept. It is a new way of doing things that respects people with disabilities' rights to do the very things that we do every day.